And these are separate issues.
I don't know.
House Committee on Revenue for March 26, 2015 will come to order. We're going to open an information meeting on transportation issues. And colleagues, please attend. Mazin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a couple of reports that you will have. This is the one that actually comes as via the constitutional requirement to look into the cost responsibility. So this is done. The report and the study is performed by the Office of Economic Analysis. That's the State Economist Office. So they will be presenting this document. In addition to that, we bring to you also today, as part of that process, a couple of issue papers. These are the forward-looking kind of research papers that the study takes every once in a while. And this time around, they will be looking at the efficient fee pilot white paper, the efficient fee as an alternative for transportation funding, and also the paper on the carbon tax and its attachment and relationships to the transportation and transportation funding. So you have here also with the state economists, a group from the, in addition to the researchers and people who looked into it, members of the study review team. They'll be able to bring to your attention a general idea of how these things have been conducted and what they have come up with. So if you would like to call them to the dais, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please. We're used to seeing you here when we're sitting with the Senate committee, so but welcome again today.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnard. I'm happy to be here today with not talking about the revenue forecast for once. This is a happy day for me, hopefully for you all too. As Mazin let you know, this is about our constitutional requirement to do a highway cost allocation study, which where we really try to see if the shares paid.
And for the record.
Oh, sorry. For the record, Mark McMullen from the Office of Economic Analysis, joined today by Carl Batten from Echo Northwest and Professor Don Negri from Willamette University.
Thank you very much.
I apologize. Go ahead. Sorry, Mr. Chair. So in terms of the study, what we're really doing is trying to see if the shares paid by heavy and light vehicles, cars and trucks, are fair in light of how much transportation or highway spending we do in a given biennium. We try to split that up, and we split that up with rates in terms of weight mile taxes for the trucks and gas taxes for the cars. And we've done this. It started in the 1930s, the first one, but for the last almost 20 years now, we've had it as a constitutional requirement to work this out. The upshot this time around is that there's right now the current rates, there are very little change in what we're charging from right now between what we're charging now and what we would consider equitable or fair. So they're very, very close to fair. And so right now our review team would not make a recommendation that the legislature has to do anything to straighten out these rates. However, if the legislature does put together a more comprehensive package where they rebase these rates, it will be only a small change, according to this most recent estimates, and the most drivers and truck drivers won't really notice the difference in what would be a fair gas tax. So while these main results are somewhat dry, particularly for us who have been through this a lot, this is old hat for Oregon, but new for a lot of states and the federal government as well. A lot of them are using Oregon's highway cost study as a model to try to figure out who's paying in their own systems. And why they're doing this is because the writing's on the wall for traditional transportation funding. We know that it's not really sustainable over the long haul. Depending on gas taxes, people are driving less and they're driving more fuel-efficient vehicles. And over time, the gas tax is becoming less effective in raising revenue. So as states are starting to think about who pays now and who's going to pay in the future, we're kind of a step ahead. And what we've started to do is move beyond the traditional study. And our study review team, which are made up of stakeholders across the board, our cars, our bikes, trucks, counties, the department, and the like, they've been interested in talking about what tomorrow's transportation system is going to look like and who would pay under that. Is that equitable and these equity implications? And it's really amazing that the groups, you know, really all come together, and they do agree that some form of efficient fee or some form of change is required going forward. And so what we've done is started to look at this, and today we've brought a couple of examples of our white papers, one being the pathway to efficient fee and the other being a carbon tax study. So to start off, I'm going to pass over to Dr. Negri, who's going to talk about the nature of the review team.
Thank you very much. State your name for the record and then give your testimony.
My name is Don Negri. I'm a professor of economics across the street at Willamette University. I have served on five study review teams, including the most recent. And let me comment briefly on the process. The study review team that reviews the contractor's analysis is made up of a diverse set of stakeholders, including the state economist, interested citizens, independent experts, ODOT administrators and staff, academics like myself, and advocates for constituencies that have a significant stake in the outcome. The SRT scrutinizes every step of the process, including the model, model assumptions, the data, issue papers, and results. SRT members also designate the issue papers, two of which you'll hear about today. They question the analysis and suggest alternative approaches. The contractor is quite responsive to the SRT's suggestions, recommendations, and requests for additional information. The outcome of this broad-based scrutiny is a process that has integrity and produces an analysis and set of recommendations that I would characterize as objective.
My name is Carl Batten. I'm with Echo Northwest, and we're the contractor who completed the highway cost allocation study for 2015. This is Oregon's 19th study. As Mark mentioned, they started in the 1930s and since 1999 have been required every 2 years to meet the constitutional requirement of determining whether light and heavy vehicles are paying their fair share. The question we ask is, are the shares of revenues paid by light and heavy vehicles fair and proportionate to their share of costs? And the way we go about answering that question is calculating what we call equity ratios for each weight class of vehicles. So, for example, if you were to calculate an equity ratio for light vehicles or cars, you would look at the share of revenues that are paid by cars as a proportion of all of revenues paid by all vehicles, and you'd look at the share of costs imposed by cars as a proportion of the all of the costs imposed by all vehicles, and then you take the ratio of those two ratios, and if it comes out to 1.0, then you have perfect equity. The cars are paying exactly the right amount to be fair. And as you'll see, we came out very close to 1.0 in this study, indicating that there's no need to change highway user fees for the purpose of making them more equitable. The way Oregon does its highway cost allocation study is to look ahead to the budgeted expenditures over the upcoming biennium and to include not just the expenditure of state highway fund money, but also the expenditure of federal revenues that are interchangeable with state money. For example, federal revenue might be spent on a project that is allocated more heavily toward trucks. But by doing so, you may be freeing up state money to be spent on a different project that would be allocated more heavily toward cars, or vice versa. And since we don't know which way that's going to go, we look at all of the expenditures together and allocate them as they are interchangeable. We also include the expenditures by local government of state user fees, the proportion of the state highway fund, your user fee collections go to the counties, and another portion goes to the cities. we count those expenditures, and we count the expenditures by local governments of federal and some of their own source revenues that are interchangeable with the state user fee money. What we don't include from the local governments is revenues like certain SDCs and property tax levies that are dedicated to particular purposes and are not interchangeable with the state user fee revenue. The results this time around, the light vehicle equity ratio is 0.9974, which is very close to 1.0, and the heavy vehicle equity ratio is 1.0047. We concluded that that's about as close to equitable as you can get and well within the range of error in the study methods. And if user fees are changed as part of a transportation package or for any other reason, the model that we developed for this study can be used to ensure that the revised fees schedules result in equitable collections in the future. And Mazin has a copy of that model.
Okay, thanks. So we're going to step aside and bring up the author of the efficient fee paper, as well as Bob Russell from the Trucking Association to make
some. Excuse me just a moment. Representative Davis, please.
Yeah, before we move on, can we ask a couple questions?
Yeah, please. Let's ask questions of this panel, and then we'll move on to other panels.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for testifying today. How does the 2015 number compare with previous years? Are we becoming more or less equitable? We're out to, what, a thousandth of a decimal point? It's pretty darn equitable, but we're compared to previous years, how do we stand?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, we are as close to 1.0 as we have ever been, and for the last several studies, we have been just barely on the side of trucks paying a tiny bit too much and cars paying a tiny bit too little, moving closer and closer to 1.0.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, so we'll start off, and Professor Negri will give a little the background of why these alternative future funding mechanisms have some appeal to economists, and then we'll get into some of the talk about the implementation and some of the issues there.
Very good. Thank you. Professor.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been asked to introduce briefly the two white papers that are part of this study. The Efficient Fee Pilot Demonstration Project issue paper develops a roadmap for how Oregon might develop a demonstration program to transition from the current highway funding mechanisms to an efficient fee to efficient fee instruments. In principle, an efficient fee charges each vehicle for the cost it imposes on each mile traveled. Let me provide an economist's perspective on why Oregon should consider an efficient fee a superior alternative to the current unsustainable funding mechanism. The principle on which funding of Oregon roads is based is cost responsibility, fairness, and equity. Cost responsibility is the cornerstone of the biennial highway cost allocation study and means that road users should pay the cost they impose on the system. Recent trends in vehicle fuel efficiency, reduced automobile travel, and alternative fuel vehicles jeopardizes the funding of Oregon roads and violates the principle of on which the Oregon highway system is financed. The combined impact of these trends severs the link between road use and road revenue. Funding of roads using the current tax system is, in the long run, not sustainable. And while alternative fuel, hybrid, high-efficiency vehicles are welcome contribution to greenhouse gases, they do not pay their fair share of road costs. Why consider an efficient fee? In short, because it saves money, in that it uses the existing infrastructure more efficiently, and because it is fair in that it is based on the principle of cost responsibility. Not only is the current system developing an inequity, it also does not account for the system cost associated with increased use. That is, it doesn't account for congestion. When a car or a truck enters a congested roadway, it imposes cost on all the vehicles in the stream. Since the price of entering the crowded system is not conveyed to the driver of the vehicle, the price of entry is essentially zero, and the demand for road capacity exceeds the supply. The cost in lost time and delayed business deliveries is significant. And we pay for the lost time even if the congestion does not materialize. For example, uncertain about the traffic conditions, I leave my house 30 minutes early to ensure that I make a flight at PDX. If there is congestion, I sit in traffic more confident that I will make my flight. If the traffic is light, I waste 30 minutes marveling at the new carpet at PDX. Either way, the uncertainty associated with congestion has cost me a half hour on every airport trip. And to give you some perspective, PDX handled 16 million passengers just last year. Congestion also promotes the state to also prompts the state to build capacity, while the revenue from the users of that capacity do not necessarily cover the expansion costs. Under the current system, the cost of expanded capacity may be borne by those who do not benefit or who live in regions, other regions of the state. That is inconsistent with the principles of equity on which our road system is built. An efficient fee charges each vehicle the cost it imposes for each mile traveled. Prices will be higher during peak times to encourage travelers to consider alternative times or alternative routes. Lower off-peak prices will encourage travelers to use the system when it's not congested. Thus, a well-designed and implemented variable fee system would use existing resources more efficiently, reduce the need for expanded capacity, and give countless years of time back to Oregonians. In addition, a well-defined efficient fee system would also more effectively guide investment in expanded capacity by providing accurate price signals to users. Congestion revenues will, over time, fund the required capacity expansion. Those who benefit by the expanded capacity are the same travelers who will pay for that expanded capacity. Indeed, there are many significant challenges to overcome. To implement such a system, safeguarding privacy and an effective technology to operate the system are two of the biggest. But a variable fee system is innovative, efficient, cost-saving, and fair, and is worthy of continued study.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matthew Kitchen. I'm with Eco Northwest, and we did author a white paper that looked at how one might proceed, sort of next steps, if one was considering how to demonstrate or do a pilot study that would look at efficient fees in Oregon. The basic principles and the methods have been considered as part of the highway cost allocation study over a number of years, including in 2011, when an alternative method for calculating the results of the equity ratios based on cost allocation methods was implemented as a benchmark to test against current fee structures. And the methods are essentially fairly straightforward. They respect the cost, as Professor Negri indicated, they respect the cost that individual vehicles impose on the other users of infrastructure or on the infrastructure itself in terms of wear and tear. And it allows us to think about designing a fee system that could be tested in a real-world application setting. So what exactly are the components of an efficient fee to sort of reduce it to its constituent pieces? The largest components would be ones that are fairly familiar to all of you. They are the costs that vehicles impose on infrastructure in terms of the ongoing maintenance and preservation of those assets, but they're also the costs that vehicles impose upon other users of this of the infrastructure in terms of time delay, the congestion costs, the time that folks are stuck in traffic, their own resources that are essentially lost as part of that overburdening of the capacity. They could, of course, include other costs, such as the pollution costs that vehicles impose. And it's likely there would need to be a component of an efficient fee that would simply address the ongoing administration of transportation services statewide. The opportunity is to improve fairness beyond what is already essentially a benchmark for fairness in terms of Oregon's thinking about how cost responsibility matches with the way revenues are implemented. And there's an opportunity potentially to really address some long-term, more fundamental and structural issues in transportation finance with an efficient fee. One of the interesting things about an efficient fee system is that it really would begin to turn the way we finance transportation infrastructure a little bit upside down on its head. And the revenues would, from an efficient fee, especially a congestion fee, would accrue over time and would be available for making investments when they're most needed. As opposed to the current system, which essentially waits until congestion is bad enough that we find a political solution to the problem and then finance that investment with either a capital program that needs bonding or with a pay-as-you-go system that may or may not match well with the costs that are imposed by the new infrastructure needs. So this is a fairly radical transformation in terms of just thinking about how finance might work for transportation sector. A little bit of background and context about I had the fortune of being able to manage a pilot project up in the Seattle region about a decade ago, where we exposed a group of volunteer participants to such a fee system with fees that varied by time of day and location, in order to mostly understand behavioral response to such a program. But we also, from that information, were able to, this was a program that we administered over about a year and a half. It was a rich behavioral data set, but it also gave us an opportunity to think about what's the relationship between efficient fee and the economy more broadly if we were to manage our infrastructure more effectively. And the user benefits from such an efficient fee program are substantial, and in the case of the Central Puget Sound region, over a 30-year implementation, the present value of those benefits were in the many tens of billions of dollars. That was essentially the time resources that we were recapturing for people through the management of the congestion problem we have up there. There's also a significant opportunity for revenue, and those revenues are in a region like the Central Puget Sound are certainly needed in terms of the ability to finance new infrastructure for a growing metropolitan area. And then one final observation from that experiment was that we were able to better understand something that's fundamental for financing new investments in a network, and that is where the revenues were generated, what specific facilities were generating revenues that were sufficient to allow for investments, where those revenues were generated from fees on users of the infrastructure, so they have essentially demonstrated to everyone that they're willing to pay for that new capacity by using the facility at a charge. That's a pretty compelling piece of information that is the kind of investment guidance that we currently don't have in the financial system that we have for transportation. So in our current effort in outlining some of these issues in a white paper, we really focused mostly on if you were interested in demonstrating such an efficient fee program in Oregon, what would the steps be? And it would clearly involve a fair amount of design work up front to make sure that there's clarity on the objectives of a pilot project. There's been a lot of demonstration work that's gone on in variable fees in transportation, either domestically and a lot more abroad. But So at this point in the sort of research community, at least, it's very important to have some clarity about which issues are most important to address in the demonstration project. And we have some suggestions on that in a moment. But also, it's going to be clearly important to involve the most congested parts of the state in this kind of a design process, as those are the ones that are going to be most directly affected by the kinds of variable fees that would address the congestion problems. And then, of course, there needs to be some real clarity about what the expectations of the demonstration would be to ensure that results are useful to a body like this. In particular, based on the work that's been done elsewhere, I think what's useful to understand is that the technology that might be used to charge vehicles, the cost they impose, is pretty much a proven set of technologies. There's not a lot that needs to be done to demonstrate the technical components of this, but there are lots of other issues that are important that are not as well understood, and those are certainly how such a program might really affect the incidence of payment, how equitable that is, not just on a user class, light vehicles versus heavy vehicles, but across multiple dimensions of users of the system. And of course, if there's a program in place that charges vehicles directly for the use of individual pieces of infrastructure, there are going to be some attendant privacy issues that are going to need to be sufficiently understood and safeguarded. Privacy needs to be addressed and safeguarded. And those are the kinds of dimensions of such a program that are probably most useful to test in a demonstration.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, excuse me just a moment.
Are we now moving to a different subject?
I think we are. Same topic?
Same topic.
Why don't you go ahead, okay, and then we'll get to your question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah,
however you would like to do it.
I saw that change, so that's what got me
worried.
Oh,
no. No, we're not talking about that.
Okay.
He's, of course, very interested in pursuing that topic.
No, I just wanted to welcome you to Transportation Conan, Ted Lamb. Seriously, I think it's really important that you know that there is a group of folks that are thinking about the future for transportation funding and finance, and we have been thinking about it in depth. You'll see that the reports that are attached on OLIS are quite extensive. We've really been working on this very hard. There are some features of this that the trucking industry likes a lot. And one of them is that you are paying for the infrastructure as you go. So built into the congestion charge is the cost of future expansion of the transportation system. So it's much like a business with depreciation. They depreciate an asset, they put the money aside, then they have the money to buy or replace the asset. And the same would be true in this case, is we would be putting money aside for future expansion based on the level of congestion. If the service level of the facility went to failure, you'd already have the money to address that problem. So that's really important. The second thing is this process would create maximum utilization of the entire transportation network. I mean, that's the concept. Former Senator Starr used to say that if you gave him a tolling system in the Portland freeways, he would solve the congestion problem like that, mm-hmm, because he would toll all the people that didn't want to pay the money off of the freeways. Well, this is like that. That's an extreme example, except what it does is it charges you for each type of infrastructure at a different level so that you've got maximum utilization of all of it. So an example, a lot of folks jump on the freeway in Portland and go down one to the next exit and then get off because they're just making a local trip. If the local streets were priced lower than the freeway, then the inducement would be to stay off the freeway and leave that capacity for through traffic and stay on the local roads and get where you're going, because it's not going to take you that much longer and you're going to save money. So that's a really important feature of what we're doing, And you are also, you would change the charges based on time of day. So when during congested periods, the charges would be higher. In the middle of the night, they may be very, very low or even nothing because there's plenty of capacity available. We were talking earlier with the Senate Transportation Committee, and we were talking about Lancaster Boulevard, which is very congested in the early evening with all the strip malls and stores and restaurants and all that stuff. Well, in theory, one senator was talking about living there and going down the street to his favorite restaurant. Well, in theory, if it was priced appropriately, and then you could choose to go at 7 o'clock for dinner at a higher price to use the facility, or you could go at 5:30 and you would pay less for the transportation infrastructure because it wasn't as congested. So it's that kind of economic incentive to create maximum utilization of the infrastructure. And you couple efficient cost allocation with least cost planning, which those of you that were around in 2009, you directed the Department of Transportation to create a least cost planning system, which we've got sort of the first iteration of that already. But what that says is that you look at the transportation need and you then invest in whatever would meet that need that costs the less. So again, going back to my example, if the freeways got congested, you could decide to either expand the freeway system or you could decide to expand the local street system and get people off the freeway back on local streets, and that may cost less. Or you could use a transit alternative or those kinds of things. So you put this economic sort of incentive system of efficient fee cost allocation together with least cost planning, and you've sort of got a balanced system that's self-perpetuating. That is the ultimate sort of goal that we're trying to achieve. Now, you know that last session you asked ODOT to do a pretty significant VMT pilot program that kicks off the 1st of July. And they do not have the bandwidth right now to sort of start working on this. And we certainly understand that, although a VMT-type tax is very important, it is part of the efficient fee cost allocation system. So we will probably be back in 2017 in suggesting some baby steps to move us in the direction of the efficient fee method of cost allocation. And I'll stop there, and if there's any questions for our panel.
Now, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for testifying. I had a couple of questions. One in particular related to existing data out there. So there was the discussion of the Puget Sound study, but my understanding is there's at least a few cities and maybe some larger jurisdictions around the world that implement various types of efficient fee or congestion pricing. I think London is probably the prime example right now. Anecdotally, I've heard that the costs of imposing that system have been much greater than originally anticipated, but are there other examples around the world that could inform the discussion?
Sure. There's London is probably the most well-known example of what's called a congestion charge, and it's a pretty simple charge structure. It's not necessarily what economists would consider ideal. But it's also a fairly expensive system to administer because the reasons are numerous. They needed to implement something quickly to meet a political timeline, and they chose to do video tolling. It's a fairly expensive thing to do on a transaction basis, so it has very high operating costs as a percentage of its revenue. There is quite a bit of work that's been done elsewhere on other ways of administering charges. The Dutch government did an extensive industry consultation process that got their cost down to about 5%. of what they went a system they never implemented, but that would have cost them about 5% of total revenues. This is no question more costly to administer, and anything you can imagine is going to be more costly to administer than the fuel tax, which is about as a low cost administrative fee system as you can get, at something less than 1% proceeds. And so but you know, the question is really, are those costs have to be justified with a system that provides value beyond what you've got right now? And that's the question, right?
Chair, one more follow-up?
Yes, please.
Thank you. And going back to the beginning of the presentation, statements about those who are currently using the system can impose a cost on other users and on the system as a whole without necessarily bearing that cost. How does the cost of sitting in the traffic or being early, I think the PDS example was a great one, I mean, how do you factor that piece in? Is that, it's not really an externality, or is it? What is that cost? How do you factor that into what we are already bearing? Because most people do take pretty substantial consideration into what time they're leaving and getting on the freeway, at least those of us who are in the metro area.
Yeah. And as I mentioned, either way, you bear the cost of congestion, even if the congestion doesn't materialize, because you leave early. That half hour that in my example, even if there is no congestion, is still time that I gave up, as I said, to look at the carpet, the new carpet at PDX. It's still time that almost everyone gives up when they anticipate the uncertainty associated with the congestion. And as you expand, since they're not spending any money, since they're not spending sufficient money, they are sitting in traffic. They are burning gasoline, and in that sense, they're paying for the roadway that they're currently sitting on, but not necessarily the full cost, which would be equivalent to the efficient fee. And thus, that's being subsidized by non-users, either from other parts of the state or other parts of the region.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I think that last comment really got back to the point that Mr. Russell was making about how to get out of that. Yeah. Other questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you. This is an interesting idea. It was curious. So the difference in the fees, right? You know, higher fees to direct people to not use that and to find alternative routes. When those fees, so you'll have a very good sense of who's using what roads, or not who, but how much the roads, who and how much people are using the roads. When this potentially could have more impact, though, on city streets and other streets versus the federal highway system. So is there a way, I mean, is the other part of this is how the money then would be spent in the upkeep of those roads?
The investment questions are often somewhat independent from questions about tax policy, but the nice thing about an efficient fee is that relationship becomes much tighter, at least the opportunity for that relationship becomes much tighter. And as I think I mentioned in the Central Puget Sound region when we did this trial project, we had very good information about where the revenues were being generated. And if you were a business in the private marketplace and you were generating revenues in one part of your market and failing to make investments in that part of your market, you would soon be outcompeted by other folks in the industry, right? So it's not unreasonable to think that with that information, now government has the ability to make investment decisions that are informed by where the users are willing to pay for new infrastructure or improvements in mobility.
I mean, there would be charges for both using the freeway and the local street system. They would just be at different levels. And we've sort of focused on the congestion part of the fee, but there would also be a maintenance component to the fee, so that the wear and tear on local streets, that money would go back to those local streets to fix them, as it would for the freeways themselves. So there is a multi pieces to the fee. And if you sort of go the next step, from a policy perspective, you could add additional components to the fee if you were interested in recapturing the cost of other things associated with transportation, like emissions.
Thank you. Other questions? I think we're going on to the next segment. Thanks.
Let me begin by introducing the next paper while my colleagues are trading seats. This paper is called the Carbon Tax Issue Paper. As I prepared this testimony, I could not help but wonder if the warm winter, diminished snowpack, and consequent summer water shortages, and several years of drought in the southern part of the state were portents of what type of future we can expect with climate change. Obviously, I don't know if these weather conditions are climate change related, but those are exactly the changes that scientists have predicted for Oregon. Drought and a warm winter have inflicted significant costs, especially on southern Oregon farmers and snow-dependent businesses. The carbon tax issue paper, which we are going to talk about, investigates the impact on Oregon of a carbon tax applied to the fuels based on their carbon content. In this issue paper, the evidence from the analysis conducted by Northwest Economic Research Center indicates that a carbon tax is not necessarily associated with lower economic output. In fact, this research shows that a strategic use of revenues from the carbon tax can lead to net increases in employment and output. I will let the authors provide the details. Although scientists have established that carbon emissions contribute to climate change, the prices we pay for fuel and other goods and services that emit carbon do not include that environmental cost. Economists call this an externality. Carbon emissions impose a real social cost, but the costs are external or excluded from the price of goods and services that contribute to climate change. That is, the price of fuel does not transmit to the consumer the cost of carbon emissions that are imposed on the environment. A carbon tax would make the prices we pay for gas reflect the climate change costs we impose. From a personal perspective, I believe that we have an obligation to future generations, to our children's children, to be proactive and not bystanders in the effort to slow climate change. The scientific community has strongly and unambiguously advocated for a reduction in carbon emissions as a means of alleviating the damage associated with climate change. In response, many local, regional, and national governing bodies are considering policies or implementing policies to reduce carbon emissions. A carbon tax is one of those policies that is efficient, effective, and fair for Oregon to contribute to stable climate and potentially a stronger economy and certainly a better future for our children. Although climate change must ultimately be addressed at the national and international level, Oregon leadership can be a catalyst for broader action. A carefully designed carbon tax can harness the power of the free market to reduce our reliance on carbon-based fuels and mitigate the damaging impacts of climate change. Granted, the logistics and politics of a carbon tax are complex, but in the past, Oregon has provided leadership in implementing innovative environmental policy, and other states have followed, and the nation have followed Oregon's lead. Thank you.
Thank you. And colleagues, as I understand it, this study is similar to the one that we've already seen, but it focuses specifically on transportation.
For the record, I'm Jeff Renfro with the Northwest Economic Research Center at Portland State University, and that's precisely correct. So if you want to... everything I'm going to talk about today comes out of the same modeling that we built for the SB 306 study that we've presented to you before. So even though I'm going to be focused on impacts on demands for transportation fuel, we're considering a policy that is a complete carbon tax. So everything I'm going to talk about assumes that we apply the carbon tax to fossil fuels combusted in Oregon, as well as electricity that's generated outside of the state but imported for Oregon consumption. We're using the revenues generated through this process to achieve a variety of ends, whether it's reducing existing taxes and fees, targeting investment, dedicating that revenue to highway and road construction around the state. So with that, just like a little bit of background before I get into some of the results. So generally, as a rough rule of thumb, if we're talking about $1 per ton carbon tax, that translates to roughly a 1 penny per gallon, or 1 penny increase in the price per gallon of gasoline. So if we're talking about a $30 per ton carbon tax, we would expect a gallon of gas to go up by 29 cents or so. There is a significant revenue potential associated with this. At $30 per ton, we estimate that the tax would generate about $1.5 billion in revenue annually. At $100 per ton, it would be about $3.5 billion annually. And then very early in our process...
excuse me, before you go on, is that assuming no response from the public to change the way in which they get around?
Representative Barnhart.
Is that a static analysis or a dynamic one?
Representative Barnhart, it's totally dynamic. So I'll show you on the next slide sort of a schematic, an overview of how the modeling worked. But everything we're talking about assumes that that initial price increase is put in place, people react to it, revenue is collected, and then that revenue is put back into the economy. So everything we're talking about is the net effect of that whole dynamic process.
But part of that reaction might be to find a different way to get around.
Representative Barnhart, precisely. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And so as a note, early in our process, we spoke with legislative counsel, and they told us that according to constitutional requirements, if you impose a tax on transportation fuels, that revenue goes to the highway fund. So that's a pretty good chunk of the revenue that you would generate. Depending on the price, the use of the revenue, the year that you're talking about, it would be between about 41 and 51% of the revenues. So I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but this is a schematic that shows the, our modeling process. And the reason that I'm showing this is so we basically take several different models and several different forecasts and put it all together. So we start off with a forecast of fossil fuel prices and a forecast of the carbon content of fossil fuels that come from the National Energy Modeling NEMS, National Energy Modeling System. So this really is the best energy price forecast that's available. And then we have economic and emissions models that, that we customize for the state of Oregon. So our economic baseline that we're forecasting out into the future matches as closely as possible the actual economic conditions here in Oregon. And then our emissions model, we worked with Department of Energy and PUC and Department of Environmental Quality to make sure that our forecasts of baseline emissions matches what the state thinks is going to happen. So when I show you a baseline forecast for petroleum use here in Oregon, it matches what Department of Energy would tell you. And then everything, as I said earlier, is fully dynamic. So there's price pass-throughs, all of that is occurring. So this is the first result I'll show you. And in our broader report, we modeled a lot of different scenarios. So a lot of different prices, different carbon prices, and then a lot of different uses for the revenue. And the examples I'm going to show you today, I'm just going to present one scenario. And that scenario is we impose the carbon tax up front. We collect that revenue, and we take the transportation-related revenue, and we dedicate it to the highway fund. That's an important note. I'll talk about that in a bit. And then we take the non-transportation revenue. We dedicate 70% of it to cutting corporate income taxes, and we dedicate 30% of it to cutting personal income taxes. As a note, what we find is for carbon prices less than $100, if we're focused on impacts on fossil fuel demand, the use of the revenue actually doesn't have much of an impact on that. It has an enormous impact on the employment and output incomes, things like that. But what happens is you impose the price on the front end. People react to that, so they reduce their fossil fuel usage. They change their behavior in some way, so we see a decline in fossil fuel demand. Then when you take that revenue and you put it back into the economy, you see impacts on employment and output. So the economy can sort of come back to its baseline or slightly exceed that, but there'll be a reaction to that. But even when you put that revenue back into the economy, you still have that price signal that's at the core of this. So even if employment and output go back to sort of normal forecasted levels, you still have people living in sort of this new future with consistently higher energy prices. So as a result, that drop in fossil fuel demand is pretty stable throughout our forecast period. So in this, we're looking at total petroleum fuel demanded in Oregon. So in Oregon, this is almost exclusively transportation related. That's really what Oregonians use petroleum fuels for. So as you can see, depending on the price we look at, that red line is $30 per ton. And then the purple line, second from the bottom, is $100 per ton. We see potentially pretty significant drops in petroleum demand below our baseline, below our expected baseline. So if we go to the next one and we break this out by region, so in our study, we break Oregon into six different regions. One I'd like to draw your attention to is the purple line in the bottom is the Portland metro area. We see the biggest decrease in petroleum demand below our baseline. And there's a couple different reasons for this. In the overall economic impacts, we do see consistently negative employment and output impacts in the Portland area. It's fairly small relative to the size of the Portland economy, but it is consistently below our expected baseline. So there's some decrease in economic activity that's associated with a drop in fossil fuel demand. And then also people in Portland just have more ability to find alternatives. So if you live in a dense urban setting, if the price of gasoline goes up, it's easier for you to take the bus, to ride a bike, to walk. So the elasticities that are sort of cooked into the model reflect the fact that people in urban areas have an easier time adjusting to this. So the last one that I'll show you, so this is, that should say, motor gasoline fuel demanded by households. So this is, we're looking at the subset of that total petroleum demand. We're looking at just gasoline used to operate private vehicles, basically. So we're looking at the same price levels. And again, we see potentially pretty significant declines in gasoline demand below our baseline. So just a few notes to wrap up with. So when we're doing sort of complicated modeling like this, we're always looking for empirical research, or we're looking for something outside of our math to validate what we've done. And when you look at British Columbia and the results or what they've seen with demand for gasoline there, it really matches what we're modeling. So in 2008, British Columbia instituted their tax. In 2008, there was also a global recession. So if you look at Canadian and British Columbia GDP in 2008, there's a pretty steep decline. If you look at gasoline demand in Canada and British Columbia, there's a steep decline associated with that drop in economic activity. But then in about 2010, Canada started to recover from the recession. They were pretty early out of it. So you see, when you look at GDP after 2010, you see Canada and British Columbia GDP recover. And in that period from 2010 to 2014, British Columbia and the Canadian GDP growth rate have roughly matched each other. But then when you look at gasoline demand, in 2010, Canada's gasoline demand starts to go back up, and it's gotten to a point where it matches the pre-recession levels, whereas British Columbia has never rebounded. It sort of hit that bottom in the recession, and then it's been roughly flat since then. So it's too early to sort of make a definitive tie between the carbon tax and that outcome, but it's pretty clear that something has sort of fundamentally changed between the connection between gasoline demand and economic output in British Columbia. As I said, we see our largest reductions in gasoline demand and transportation fuel demand generally in the Portland area. And then because this is a transportation-focused presentation, when we look at employment in the transportation by trucking industry, which I imagine if you ask people the industries that might negatively be affected by a carbon tax, truck transportation is probably one that people would guess. If the revenues are used to add to the highway fund, so in effect what happens is a sort of a big public works project around the state to improve and build new highways. We actually see a very small increase in trucking employment around the state, and that's motivated by this expansion in construction. So with that, that's it for me, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chairman Barnard, I do have a couple of very, very brief comments to pass along. We're missing a couple of our stakeholders here because of spring break, and so I thought I'd pass along a couple of their comments about the broader thing. Again, it was nearly unanimous that the efficient fee or some form of it is the way of the future among our group. In order to implement that, you're going to need something along the lines of a VMT for the informational, hurdles to go there. So that's basically they're all, but of course there are some caveats there. For one, our bicycle advocates wanted to make sure that we talked about the movement to this sort of thing, and in particular, right now the holes in our gas tax being, say, electrical vehicles or high mileage vehicles or alternative transit or bikes and the like. To try to cover up this hole, a lot of policymakers are thinking about registration fees or increasing title fees and the like. From an efficiency or an economic perspective, this is actually moving in the opposite direction of an efficient fee, opposite direction of paying for use. It's even worse than the gas tax. We pay once up front. No matter how often we use the electric car, we're going to pay the same amount. And so from an efficiency standpoint, that's not the best, even though it does capture some of the holes. Another comment from the Department of Transportation would like to reflect the fact that when we look at these international comparisons of efficient fee structures and whatnot, in their research over time, they found that Oregonians are particularly sensitive to tolls, or at least they don't like tolls a lot. And so when we look at these other areas, they may react less to these tolls in terms of their behavioral responses. And finally, in terms of the AAA and the cars, they feel that that efficient fee structure would be desirable over a carbon tax. A carbon tax is nice in terms of the emission reductions, but what it doesn't give you are some of this ability to really drill down into congestion or to talk about the impacts of different weights of heavy vehicles and the like, that we get all this wonderful information user data out of an efficient fee system that doesn't naturally come out of a carbon tax. So we would need to supplement the carbon tax with some traditional weight mile things or whatnot to get a system that works. So that's it for our prepared comments, but we'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions for this panel? Representative Vance, please.
Just one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for all your work on this. Extremely timely and very interesting. The underlying assumption for the studies appears to be we must reduce CO2. The question I have is how do we determine relative programs' value in achieving that end? Carbon tax is one device to reduce the use of carbon-based fuels and thus results in a reduction. But I need to know where I can look to figure out how we can measure these programs against each other and find out which ones work the best. That's one question that Mr. Chair had a follow up.
Yes.
Go ahead with that first.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz. So at this point, we're sort of right at the beginning of being able to compare actual implemented programs against each other. So when we started our look into carbon pricing generally, one of the reasons that we focused on a carbon tax for our 2013 study was British Columbia was really the only example of a economy-wide, broad-based carbon pricing policy, and it seemed to be working fairly well. So that's why we looked into that. At this point, California has implemented a cap-and-trade system. So in the next couple of years, you'll probably be able to compare not only changes in emissions and impacts on the economy, but then really look at the ease of implementation of those programs.
Well,
yes, please. Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, the issue here is, rather than join the herd of folks zooming toward carbon reduction, the issue is how can we do it better, smarter, faster, more efficiently? I don't really think that we're the same as California. We certainly aren't the same as British Columbia. Mm-hmm. And the issue is how do we make sure that whatever we're doing isn't because we want to be a leader when we're such a small state. I don't think we can afford that. We need to do it better, faster, more efficiently. So what I'm asking is, where can we find the studies that show us the best means of achieving this outcome and make it Oregon-centric in achieving that answer? The reason I say it, I want to put it this way. We are blessed with millions of acres of forest, which suck up carbon like there's no tomorrow. They're great at it. It seems to me that in trying to figure out how we invest our dollars, we would take into account that which we are doing already and then work our way out from that point. But I didn't see that in your presentation. What I saw was, and I think that's the purpose of the study, was to say how well would a carbon tax work to drive down. The underlying assumption is that all driving down of carbon creation is good. I want to go beyond that. I want to ask, yeah, sure, it's good, but how can we do it better? And how do we get to the point of figuring that out? Because just to say someone else is doing it, that's not good enough for us now. I don't think we can enjoy that luxury. I don't think we have that. We don't have that luxury now. If the situation is as grim as some people suggest, then I'm not enthused about the justifications I've heard for this so far. But if you come in and say Oregon only creates 60 million tons of carbon a year, China and U.S. create about 15 billion tons a year, thus a reduction of one ton in Oregon is as good as anywhere else, then my question to you would be, how can we do it better, more efficiently? Is this the best way? That's what I'm asking you guys. Where can I find those answers?
Representative Barnhart, Representative Bentz.
Fabulous question.
So one of the reasons that we focused on we didn't focus on things like incorporating carbon offsets or carbon capture and forests and things like that is after speaking with the people who implemented the tax up in British Columbia, really their strategy was if you look at the main sources of carbon emissions in any jurisdiction, a lot of it is going to be from combustion of fossil fuels. So in Oregon, combustion of fossil fuels is about 83% of our total emissions. So when we were looking at this, we, as sort of a general principle, we said we're not going to suggest anything where we say you need to create a new department to do this. So in our Fuller SB306 study, we took a lot of care to identify existing programs, existing departments, existing offices that are doing something similar to what would need to be done to implement the policy. And we say there's a lot of other ways to reduce carbon. There are other programs that we're just not considering right now, but they would take something that's more complicated than what we're considering. So I think from the economic theory perspective, the difference between a cap and trade or a carbon tax, you could make either one of them work. Based on our research and looking at how these things have been implemented so far, we think that the implementation of a carbon tax could be significantly easier. And then from there, you take out a big chunk of your emissions, and then you can start thinking about other programs or other areas where you could further reduce emissions to add on to that. But this is a sort of British Columbia considers it sort of the backbone of a broader carbon reduction policy.
Thank you.
Other questions? May I just simply add to what Representative Bentz said, because I think he very articulately stated the key questions that we are all facing. You're not the only ones who have been aware of this winter. And of course, one winter doesn't tell you very much by itself, but it is, in the context that we've been living, this past winter is quite frightening, at least to some of us. because of what it may suggest about the future. The question that Representative Bentz asked is, I think, the key to the problem. And let me just illustrate quickly with one of your slides, the one in which you talked about changing fuel demand by households. You showed that by 2029, if we imposed a $150 tax, carbon tax, we'd have a 20% reduction. I have to tell you that either that is extremely pessimistic, or we're in much worse trouble than I thought we were. We need much greater than 20% reduction in fossil fuel use in the world by 2029 in order to have any shot of getting out of the problem that we face. And it's an urgent, urgent problem. So the question that Representative Bentz asked is a key question. What are the various pieces, this being one of them, but other things that we can do that will make a difference? Let me suggest a couple of things. Everyone here knows that I'm a strong proponent of using electric vehicles rather than gasoline-powered vehicles. It's somewhat of a joke in the legislature. I have to tell you that I don't think it's a joke at all. I think the reality is that by 2029, a very significant percentage of people in the United States who use automobiles will have to be using alternate fuels vehicles, and most of them electric, if we're to have any chance at all of getting our fossil fuel use down to where it needs to be. And, of course, we will have to have reformed our electric generation system in that same time period, in order to reduce the amount of coal we're burning to make that electricity. So I hope your study is extremely pessimistic, because you've looked at only one issue, and that is the price of carbon-based fuels. There are technological changes happening all the time which are vastly more optimistic in their outlook than I think your study contemplates, based on the question I asked last time you presented the other piece of this study. And therefore, I hope that but I have to say, this scenario you've presented with a carbon tax is politically very problematic, and yet the results that it would produce are not nearly enough in terms of the outcome we have to have. So all of us, the people at the, on the panel, the experts out there in the world who are working on this stuff, we need to do crash programs to figure out how these things interact, what kind of incentives we can actually use to move carbon fossil fuel use down, and how we can get ourselves very close to zero very fast, and probably faster than certainly than any of the study here would suggest we have a chance of getting to. As the climate worsens in the world, I think other people besides Representative Bentz and myself will feel the urgency to do that. I know many of my constituents are way past where I am in terms of their sense of urgency. So as we look at these issues, we are going to have to do exactly what Representative Bentz has suggested. We're going to have to turn up every rock. We're going to have to look at every possibility. We're going to have to take a 3% here and a 5% over there and a 10% over there and figure out what incentives we need to provide and what public relations we need to do, and what encouragement we need to make that are simply bully pulpit types of things in order to get these kinds of the results we need. I really appreciate the study you presented to us. If this is what we have, I'm very pessimistic about the long-term outcome. Anything else? Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. We'll hope that this is just a beginning for our work. And again, thank you, Representative Bentz, for your question.
Thank you, Chair.
You didn't expect it to trigger a tirade from your chair, but I appreciate it anyway.
Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you today.
Thank you. All right. With that, we'll close the information meeting. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2126. Colleagues, I will note as we get ready to start this public hearing that we have two important bills before us today and about 25 minutes to work them or to hear them. So we'll ask the presenters to be efficient in the use of time and see if we can get as far as we can through these two items.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2126, what it would do is it would add the definition of non-residential use for purposes of vertical housing development zone program. That definition would be any use that is not exclusively residential use. It would extend the sunset date for the new vertical housing zone designation and application for the partial property tax exemption to January 1, 2026, and would take effect the 91st day following sine die. And just to give a very brief background, this is an existing partial property tax exemption. And as the name implies, it's vertical housing. So the idea is this housing would be partially residential and then partially something else. The value of the exemption does depend upon the number of equalized floors dedicated to residential use. So as for one floor, for example, would be a 20% exemption. Four more floors would be 80% of the improvement property would be exempt. The land is only subject to the exemption if the residential property is used for low-income residential housing. So initially it would be the improvements that are exempt, but you could also the property could qualify under the as well if it's low-income residential housing. I do have up an OLIS I pulled from the Department of Housing's website, which administers the program, or at least it has to approve the requests for the exemption. From their website is a list of the different vertical housing development zones that exist. And just as a note, the current for this current partial exemption, the sunset date right now is 12/31/2015. Now the exemption lasts for a maximum of 10 years, so those properties that are currently receiving the partial exemption can continue to do so for the full 10 years if they continue to qualify. But the sunset itself really is for the new designations of zones and also new properties coming in. So those that are getting the exemption right now can continue to do so until that 10-year limit is up.
Thank you. I'm just going to go down the list. We have four people to testify, and Mayor Doyle, Eric Collar, Randy Tucker, and Aaron Doyle of Legal City. So why don't you come up and give your testimony?
Thank you, and I will be brief, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Bernard, members of the House Revenue Committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. For the record, my name is Denny Doyle, and I'm the mayor of the city of Beaverton, and that's why I'm here, and to present Beaverton's strong support for House Bill 2126. Mm-hmm. The Vertical Housing Development Zone program provides an economic development tool for many cities across the state of Oregon, including Beaverton, Central Point, Eugene, Grants Pass, Gresham, Klamath Falls, Hillsboro, LeGrand, Medford, Milwaukee, Monmouth, Oregon City, Roseburg, and Springfield. This program works because it creates economic development and housing density in areas and in cities where it makes sense. The Vertical Housing Development Zone is not a state tax credit. The cities that choose to create the zones give up local property tax. We do not do this lightly. We do it strategically. Simply put, the Vertical Housing Development Zone program helps a mixed-use project pencil out by offering developers a 20% property tax abatement per floor of development, up to 80% maximum abatement of the residential portion of the building's value. The maximum length of the abatement for any project is 10 years. As you can see on the map of Beaverton, we have strategically and thoughtfully designated three target areas of the city for this density development. These are areas that have remained underdeveloped for years, and I mean years, or have development challenges. Beaverton has two projects getting started in the downtown zone, including one with live-work components. You have letters from those developers, Rimbolt Properties and Central Bethany Development in OLIS, that detail out the critical role this program plays in getting their projects to pencil out so we can get them done. There's also a letter from Petercourt Management Company, which is looking to use this program in another one of our zones. We believe this program will be an important part of revitalizing our downtown, but the sunset date needs to be extended for that to happen. As I mentioned earlier, it bears repeating, we do not give up property tax lightly. We do it to leverage economic development and desired density. For example, by foregoing $160,000 annually for 10 years on the Rembo project, we help make a $21.5 million investment in Beaverton pencil out for a long, long time. Because this is a partial tax exemption in this particular project, only 60% will apply to the residential portion of the building's value. We'll see the benefits of economic development right away without any loss of revenue from the land value. We believe this is a wise investment. It's a conscious decision we've made as a city. This is an opportunity for cities around the state that simply choose to use this type of incentive program to meet the housing and economic development needs of their communities. Please join me in supporting House Bill 2126, and thank you. Hopefully I was brief enough.
You were. Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I think Mayor Doyle did a great job of explaining the program. I'm not going to repeat what he had to say. I'd like to call your attention to the testimony that I have submitted on behalf of our Director of Planning and Development, Alyssa Gertler. Should be in OLIS. And in particular, I'd like you to call your attention to the portion or the materials that are attached to that testimony. There are some sort of fact sheets about projects that have been built in the Portland metropolitan region, not in Portland though, in Gresham, Milwaukee, and Hillsborough, that are mentioned in the testimony. But these fact sheets are descriptions of transit-oriented development projects that we've been involved with, but that have many public partners. Basically, we have a whole program in transit-oriented development that is intended to help to facilitate these kinds of projects where they don't otherwise pencil out, as the mayor just said. And that is outside the city of Portland, where the rents aren't as high, and so it's harder to make these projects work financially. Usually there's a layering of several different incentives in order to make these things work. And then when they do get built, they act as catalysts for development of the surrounding neighborhood. So they really are important projects to the communities in our region. So I just want to give you that kind of context. The one thing, you've been here a while when your first session with your current job was the last time they did the 10-year sunset extension. that's true in my case. So I'm glad to see it come around again and have a chance to testify again. I want to mention one element that your staff described to you at the beginning of the hearing on this bill, and that is the definition of non-residential use. The statute requires that a project be partly residential and partly non-residential, and then the rules got more specific than that, and I'm not the guy that's going to be giving you the line-by-line analysis of the rules, but what we're trying to do is recognize the current reality where there are live-work units where there isn't necessarily a clear delineation of square footage as far as what the business or the non-residential element is and what the residential element is, and yet these are clearly residential and non-residential uses that are occurring. And so the language that describes non-residential in the statute or in the bill before you is intended to provide some more flexibility to ensure that the intent of the legislation can be carried out with respect to live-work units. I'll stop there and happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hi, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, Eric Kanzler with the City of Bend. City of Bend has a pretty extraordinary a housing crisis of pretty extraordinary proportions. I think that the last thing that I heard, our rental vacancy rate is roughly 0.25%. And I know that seems impossible, but it seems to be perpetuating itself and not getting any better. There's a lot of reasons for that, and I think that addressing it is going to require a lot of different actions. When we look at House Bill 2126, it seems to us that it's helpful on two fronts. One is that it would incentivize market rate multifamily, which is a very important portion of addressing the need for the right diversity of housing to meet the needs of our community. And it would do that without consuming raw land and without eroding the underlying tax base of the land on which the development occurs. So that's a pretty attractive opportunity. It's also exactly the kind of tool that demonstrates and can demonstrate Bend's commitment to utilizing land within its existing UGB effectively, which is a very critical component of justifying an expansion of a UGB, which we are in dire need of doing. That in turn would have an impact on land costs and housing prices as well. So we haven't used this in the past. I think there may not be a great reason for that other than the fact that the housing crisis has happened very rapidly, and now we're looking for any sensible tools. This is a very sensible tool. And I've talked to my planning staff, the affordable housing manager. They both agree. The extension of the sunset to 2026 allows the city to consider this option with a much greater degree of certainty about its future effectiveness. So I think if we had any proposed amendment, it would be to change 2026 to 2126 to match the bill number. And that might be an improvement. Outside of that, we'd urge your support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. The point of a 10-year sunset is to require us to take another look at it. So
yeah,
that's the point of it. Yes, ma'am.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I am Erin Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities in support of House Bill 2126. First, I'd like to call your attention to the list that staff shared with you of all of the diverse communities that have adopted these vertical housing zones for their, oftentimes, the benefit of their downtown communities, where you're going to see more of vertical buildings as opposed to the single family residences. You can see it's cities that vary in size quite significantly and geographically very different. I call to your attention in particular the last four cities to adopt zones from the Dalles, Tigard, Fairview, and Canobie. That's a fairly diverse set of cities and the types of cities we're looking at. The other letter I'd like to call to your attention is from the City of Grants Pass's planning commissioner, or not planning commissioner, the planning director, I apologize. Grants Pass was the first city to adopt one of these vertical housing development zones. Unexpected, I'm sure. And they have found it helped them with one project in particular, but then after 2008, development slowly fizzled out, and now they're excited that as the economy is ramping back up, there's renewed interest in looking at development within these zones. And for communities like Grants Pass or Cottage Grove, Canby, who are looking at different ways to develop economic development programs, but also create a culture of a downtown and revive their main streets, this is one tool that they can use to increase that incentivization. As development picks up, we believe there'll be more interest in developing these zones. As you can see, with four cities in 1 year, adding that program on, knowing that the sunset existed. Actually, the City of Tigard reached out to me in the 2013 session to try and get this extension because they were considering it and they wanted to be sure that they would get the full 10 years amount of use out of it. There's a lot of support for the within the communities that use this and more communities that are interested in either extending their zones, expanding their zones, or finding new places within their community. The other important thing about this project is that it's a decision that the local community is making that incentivizes the development that they want to see. So by having it as an opt-in program, they set the terms, the zones, and the type of development that they're expecting to see out of these areas. So strongly support this bill and extending this sunset, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are any brief questions? We'll start with Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify, because I don't think any of you mentioned it in your testimony, but my reading of the staff summary is that these are developments that the property tax exemption would be based on their having it being affordable.
Chair,
I'm sorry. Maybe I should be asking staff.
Well,
if the equalized floor is allocated to low-income residential housing.
Yes, Representative Smith Warner. That's just for the land to qualify for the exemption. Then it has to be dedicated to low-income residential housing.
Okay.
So it's kind of an additional exemption if it's dedicated for that purpose. But
okay.
Otherwise,
so this exemption is for any kind on the property, and you could get an additional if it were low income.
Tara Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner. If you look actually on the list, you can see, I believe they put it on their list, but there is some indication of, on occasion, oh, it's not this list. There is a list somewhere, a magic list, that the department has that talks about just regular development and then an additional low-income requirement that some cities have used to overlay. So not every project is going to be low-income. It could be market rate, but you can use it in addition to that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Davis, Representative Leininger, Representative Whitsitt, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for coming today and testifying. And this may take some follow-up, but I'm just interested in drilling down a little bit more into understanding why these projects would not pencil out without the exemption. In particular, at a time of very low vacancy rates in multifamily, where most developers that I know, and including some people I work with, are trying to get multifamily up as quickly and in as much abundance as possible, and particularly in the metro area, and also in light of the fact that we are continually told that transit-oriented development will occur. If we build it, they will come. Why is it not penciling out without a further exemption?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis, I'm going to give it a try. I would do a lot better if I had one of my transit-oriented development program people here. They'd do a lot better than I would. But I've, in other contexts, I've learned a little bit about this. This development, the kind of development, actually is more expensive in some cases, especially mixed-use development, where you've got to, because of building codes, et cetera, you have to put in particular different systems for the ground floor retail than for the residential above. You've got to put in barriers of certain types between the residential and the retail, et cetera. So in many cases, it's actually just more expensive development. Second, as I believe Mayor Doyle mentioned, some places it does pencil out. And it's places that it doesn't, that where this kind of program is important, and it's in our region, it's in the suburban communities as opposed to the city of Portland, where the rents are much higher, and city of Portland has not adopted this program. So that's two attempts to get at your question, but I would be happy to get somebody who's a lot more sophisticated about it to try to answer your question.
That'd be great. Thanks.
And Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis, and for the folks outside of Metro, the development community looks very different. The development perspectives look very different. And so by incentivizing this type of development, they can get a second story that would be otherwise fairly run down into nicer living arrangements. And that's the type of development that they've been able to incentivize outside of the metro area, probably where there isn't as much transit consideration. So,
we'll follow up.
Yep, please, yes.
Well, of course, this is only for new developments, correct?
No.
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 No,
it can be overlaid over existing buildings.
Yeah, the bill contains the current statute, and in the current statute, it refers to rehabilitation as well as new construction. So,
thank you.
So it's rehab.
Representative Leininger.
Thank you.
Yeah. So redevelopment, but not just existing building.
So I'm really a supporter of transit and. And I like the idea of infill development. I have to say that thinking from the perspective of a former Clackamas County Commissioner, I can't help but notice the parallels between this and urban renewal, you know, which, of course, was voted down essentially in Clackamas County as a tool. And I think Beaverton actually also voted to require community-wide vote on every plan. So is this... And I think Clackamas voted to require a community-wide vote on every plan, county-wide vote, which is a difficult-to-attain standard probably for Clackamas. But it's how do you see this squaring with the sentiment of folks who just said they were only comfortable with urban renewal if it was first subject to a prior vote? And I'm also really just interested in the cost. I see that the fiscal impact and revenue impact aren't apparent yet, but how does that square?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Let me take a stab.
Sure.
Randy took a stab at the cost. We went to all of our partners that have taxing property tax base and said, here's what we're doing and here's where we're doing it. We went through an analysis of potential dollars, and the one development is $160,000 tax savings per year for 10 years. Between the three major taxing districts, the value per year is $237 million. So our partners had a chance to opt out of giving a tax consideration here, and the schools did not, nor did the park district, nor did, obviously, did the city. So again, we've set these zones up very small for reasons that this one in particular sat vacant for almost 9 years. And it's really critical to the redevelopment on the south side of Broadway between our one of our major transit routes. And so that's what we were trying to do. And again, they had a chance to say no. And so our consideration is that the land is still taxed at the going rate. So if you build something up on it, obviously additional revenue comes maybe small at first, but inside of 10 years at 100%. I don't know if that helps. And, you know, we did vote urban renewal in, and so that was done by a vote of the people. These are very small things for us, but important to the developers. Sorry.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Langer. I would also add that there is an option for some of the special districts and other overlying tax districts to opt out of the abatement. So you can see on this list, specifically in the cases it's been raised to those other taxing districts, and they're able to opt out. And in addition, in the abatement, my understanding of the abatement is on the residential portions alone. So you and it for dependent upon the number of floors. So you're not seeing 100% abatement of all of it. You're seeing based on the amount of mixed use we're getting out of it, i.e. the residential part of it. That's where the abatements lie. So there are some very distinct differences, I think, between this and urban renewal. But I'm not the urban renewal expert, so please don't ask me questions about it.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt, please.
Yes. I heard you mention Klamath Falls when you were ripping that list off. Somebody verbally said Klamath Falls. Would the city or county have to approve this? If the state passes a law saying this is possible, then is it left up to the city or the county to decide whether or not they want to come under this new program?
Representative Whitsitt, it's the city's option because the vertical housing is in the city's property, and I believe it's the cities that designate the zones and is all a local process. So it's the city developing the zone. From what I've heard in the research and looking into it, in particular in Klamath Falls, oftentimes it's a developer who's interested in a particular building or property, and usually in the downtown area, that says this won't pencil out. I'd like to see this vertical housing development zone created. Is this something you're willing to work with me on? And the developer and the city kind of work hand in hand to measure out where it is they want to see this type of vertical development occur. But it's done with the cities, and they then reach out to the special taxing to other special districts and say, do you want in? Are you willing to abate as well, or do you want out? So,
okay. Well, and I have a follow-up.
Please, yeah.
What would be the criteria for rehabilitation? You talked about it's either new or rehabilitated. What are the criteria for rehabilitation of an existing building?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, I'm not sure exactly what counts as rehabilitation, but I will find out from the cities that have done it what their criteria specifically are. I just didn't get that deep into the program, and I will follow up with you.
So is it set by the cities, or is it set by the state, the rehabilitation part of this?
That's what I'm going to have. I don't have the answer to that.
Well, the definition in the statute is a substantial repair of improvements or land developments, and may be further defined by the department by rule. So the department could define it by rule. One assumes the city isn't going to go into an arrangement unless they think that it actually is going to work and that it's an appropriate offset for property taxes.
But the rule,
in addition to
the rule has not been made yet, right?
Rule exists already because the program currently exists.
Could you get copies of the rule for us?
Okay.
Let's get copies of the rule. Okay, let me simply note that in Klamath Falls, the Emergency Communications District and the Fire Protection District both opted out. Mm-hmm. So they're still collecting their taxes on that, just exactly as you were describing. Other questions for this panel? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering if it would be an oversimplification to make the correlation between the vertical housing zones as being a free market alternative to inclusionary zoning, i.e., the free market says if we could have an incentive for a particular kind of a project, and if it pencils out, we will do it, versus having some sort of governmental entity saying thou shalt include this type of development within your plans and so forth. Is that a fair assumption?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson. I feel I'm being baited. We see these programs as very different. Inclusionary zoning is going to go to could potentially, if a city opted into it because they felt it worked in their community, they could be, both programs could be used, one could be used, the other could be used, but inclusionary zoning, as is often presented, is more directed at single-family housing and not vertical housing, and less focused on redevelopment of downtowns and the economic development that comes with the commercial portion of this. It is a different type of incentive program. I understand your concerns regarding mandates to develop at a particular price point. But again, like the vertical housing, we believe that inclusionary zoning is a local process decision, and our local officials are more than capable of making the decision about how to incentivize development for their community.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you so much for the presentation today. We look forward to the information you've indicated you're going to bring us later. Mm-hmm. And is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 2126? Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2126. Colleagues, because of the time, we have already decided that we're going to set over the public hearing on House Bill 2455 till Monday. And that's the notice that I'm required to give, isn't it? All right. And with that, the committee is adjourned.